Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My name is Dave Hanratty, and there will be no encore. Remote edition. We're back in the remote bunkers this week because we're bringing back our boy. Sonic Architect Adam is here, but of course, the OG no encore co-host. My friend and yours, another marathon man, of course, having recently run one. It is live from Leakslip, Craig Fitzpatrick.
From my fortress of solitude. Dave, I told you not to mention the marathon. You know, come on, how bashful I am about it.
You absolutely did not tell me not to mention the marathon. So now that we
congratulations,
if you bring
it
by the
up,
way. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, one of many people running marathons these days. As we were chatting on the weekend, there was a prolonged discussion of running, and I found myself
sitting at a table full of people who like run, and I was just like, boy, do I feel out of shape. So yeah, I need to get myself in gear. So congrats to all of my friends who are, you know, doing marathons and stuff. You're all better than me.
You know, but anyway, we're all running from something, you know. It's
I mean, listen, I feel like I've got a I got some good music for you, you know. And I'm sure you're all over the playlist anyway. I'm sure you're making it work. But I watched I revisited a motion picture from my childhood there last week, and I just said to Adam, I was like, I think we need to honor this because I watched classic Arnold Schwarzenegger shoot 'em up Commando from the year 1985, I believe.
Yeah.
A film I would have seen when I was like 10 or something and just been completely blown away by. And it's utterly chaotic and weird. He kills an awful lot of people in various different ways. It's only 90 minutes, but the music is unbelievable. So I'm going to play you a snippet now from the motion picture Commando and the opening theme, which segues into the kind of more, the bigger motifs of the movie. Adam, I believe you whipped this up, so if we could hear it, please. Just a snippet. That's just like a sizzle reel of what this thing can do. That's the work
that
of folks. The late composer.
Not to get too graphic.
Late composer. No. It's the kind of movie to get graphic with, I suppose. It's a graphic movie. The work of the late composer James Horner. So congratulations to him on his work.
And yeah, the movie still holds up as well as soundtrack.
It's glorious trash. Absolutely glorious trash. It's exquisite.
Is that kind of in... Oh, really? Do you have any off the top of your head? I don't even remember Commando, to be honest.
We haven't even gotten anywhere near the new section yet, but okay. Arnie is an ex-Special Forces guy. His daughter's kidnapped. They're killing off members of his team. He has to save her and kill about 150 bad guys in the process. He kills a guy on a plane, breaks his neck in front of like everyone. Somehow no one notices. And then he like makes it look like he's asleep and he tells the stewardess, he's like, the flight attendant, sorry, that was very yeah. like sexist.
It was very 1985. You're just, you know.
Yeah, I was putting myself in the time period.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be anachronistic to be respectful. Yeah. In that day and age. And he's like, oh, please don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired. Drops mm-hmm. a guy off a cliff. And she's like, what happened to him? And he goes, I let him go. You know, it's great. It's really, really good.
I love it.
Arnie's fantastic.
That music is sensational. Anyway. In my honor as well, I guess, right? You just had me in mind.
I think the next time...
Relic Commando.
Yeah, the next time you do a marathon, I think you should listen to that. But I do, you know, like at the same time, while I'm, you know, kind of bringing frivolity to everything, I think it's time to kind of stop and reflect as well.
Okay.
Got a bit of listener criticism there off the last episode, so...
Oh, really?
If former guest co-host Rudy Kinsler wants to let it be known what he said to me, let's have a listen to that.
Well, Dave, hope all's good with you. Just catching up with the podcast here. Just can't help but notice that when discussing Macklemore, you said that for all these years, people have been mispronouncing it wrong. If you're mispronouncing it wrong, you'd be pronouncing it right. People have either been mispronouncing it or pronouncing it wrong. I hope someone really, really, I hope someone's ass is on the line for that one. Be it you or Adam for letting that slip through the cracks. Someone's head needs to roll for that shit.
The line, someone's head needs to roll Whoa. For that shit. I love how much Rudy cares about that. Thank you, Rudy, for the listener feedback.
Yeah, he really cares, but also he sounds like he's like slipping slowly into a coma or something from that recording.
I think he was just disgusted by what happened, you know? I mean, what is this? Some kind of magic xylophone? I hope someone got fired for that error. But no one's getting fired here. We're all in this together, guys.
Dave, I hope your response to that is, I could give a fuck.
my response to it is the truth that, like, this happens a lot. It will happen on this episode. I will definitely do that double negative thing or whatever. I misspeak oftentimes. I get people's names wrong. It happens, you know? Like it's just, you know, like, give me a break, guys. You know, I'm out here trying. I'm just a human being. But what I will say is... a lesser man would say that Rudy Kinsler is now banned from the show forever, much like I've banned Greg from the show numerous times throughout the show's history.
Of course.
He's back. In Rudy's case, however, I will happily invite him back on, but under the proviso that he can't make a single mistake. There can be no errors of any kind. And if that does happen, he will be banned from the show for life. So that's my
I feel like if you're doing that, though, the stakes should be higher. Like there should be something hanging over his head for the entirety of the record, just ready to drop if he makes an error. I'm thinking some kind of gun, maybe a guillotine. I don't know.
Adam can arrange some kind of studio trap. Nice. But listen, on this episode, Craig has arranged a top five for us. We're going through the career catalogue of New York hipsters, Vampire Weekend.
Because yeah, me talking about Weekend New York hipsters. Who'd have thunk
it? It's an area of expertise. There's a new Vampire Weekend album out in the world as of Friday. So we're going to look at some career highlights later on, as curated by Craig Fitzpatrick. And speaking of curation, before we get to the new section, we've teased it for a while now. If you are a member of our Patreon, it's patreon.com/noencore, you, of course, will get weekly episode previews. You will get episodes 24 hours early. And we are announcing a brand new spin-off show thing onto the Patreon feed. It's patreon.com/noencore. It costs about a fiver, more if you want to pay it. But Adam, would you like to explain what will be happening on Patreon from now on?
I'd absolutely love to, Dave. So this is, again, we've been teasing this for a while. And we've just spent a lot of time trying to get it ready. So what's happening is this coming Sunday is going to be the first episode of No Encore's Album Club. So what is No Encore's Album Club? Well, No Encore's Album Club is going to be myself and Dave sitting down in a periodical every 2 weeks. So it's going to be every first and third or second and fourth Sunday, however you look at it. And we're going to sit down with records that we love. We're going to go through them. We're going to do a deep dive into them, and then we're going to, I suppose, voice our thoughts on it, what we think, why we picked it, the personal relationship that we have to it. It was born out of something that I did on Instagram, actually, that Dave thought would be a really good translation onto the audio format. So I used to do it as like a little Sunday album club on my Instagram stories. I used to just post a couple of slides. It was generally stuff from my record collection. For the moment, I'm going to be using my vinyl collection, but it's not going to be exclusively to that either. So I will be posting a link on the Patreon to my vinyl collection. If there's anyone who wants to pick a record, by all means, let us know. It's patreon.com/noencore. Please sign up. But I do have a little example of what it's going to be like and for the first record. So before we do that, though, Dave.
Yeah, I just want to point out that, you know, if anyone wants to question my level of benevolence on this podcast, when Adam came to me with this great idea, not you, the listener gets to do that, okay? Not you. But here's the thing, right? I've let you back, haven't I? Numerous times, including this one.
I've been begging and begging.
Listen. People don't know what goes on behind the scenes here.
They don't.
But here's the thing,
they
right?
don't.
When it comes to Adam, I was like, great idea, sounds class, let's do it. Who's first up? And Adam said to me, Catfish and the Bottlemen. And I recoiled, Craig. Yeah. I was like, there's no way, not a chance. But let me tell you, I've heard the episode. Adam has sold it extremely well. Adam loves this band, don't you, Adam?
I'd say I love the early stages of this band, and I like the
Adam loves some of this band, don't you, Adam?
He likes the early stuff.
I love some of this band, yeah. No, the whole thing is like, my record collection encapsulates records that either like I've loved for a certain, like as part of a certain period in my life, or they have a certain sentimental value, and that's why I have them in my record collection. So that's exactly why I picked Catfish and the Bottlemen, their first record, The Balcony. I thought it was a really good place to start. I'd recently been reminded of it, and it's the 10-year anniversary of it coming out. So I didn't think there'd be a better one to start. Well, there probably is a better one to start with, let's be honest. But yeah, really, really did enjoy it.
So yeah, I mean, like the goal of this isn't to just kind of, well, it is to wax lyrical about the album in question, but it is also hopefully to provide kind of an overview of an act that maybe you've never really heard of, or an act that you want to get more into. I mean, I will say, like, coming out of hearing Adam's episode, I found myself being like, actually, okay, my opinion has somewhat changed now, and I'm much more interested in listening to this act and this album than I was going in. And for my first one, which is currently in the works, I'm really hoping to try and introduce people to an album that means a lot to me. So that's kind of the rough plan. We're going to kind of, you know, it's a work in progress, obviously. But Adam does have the first episode in the bank. It will be out this Sunday on patreon.com/noencore. And I believe you have a little preview for us, Adam.
Sure do. Let's take it away. Take it away, me. To start off, there's a record that I've gone back to recently enough. And that is due to a number of reasons. First of all, this act is a headliner of Reading and Leeds Festival this year, something I didn't see coming at all. It's an act that I've had, I wouldn't say I followed, but I definitely loved the first album, and that's the record that we're going to discuss today. It's Catfish and the Bottlemen's The Balcony.
How did you come across this name, Catfish and the Bottlemen?
The story behind that, it's a good story. That's like, my mum got run over when she was younger, couldn't have kids, and my dad really wanted a family, so like, to start, kind of try and start again, my dad like flew him out, ran off to Australia together. Despite doctors saying there's no way they're gonna be able to have a kid, not even with like IVF treatment or anything like that, my dad was like persistent and kept going, and they tried twice for an IVF baby, and they were working two jobs and putting all their money towards it, trying like their utmost to have me basically. And then on the last attempt, which was gonna be the last attempt because they were like killing them to keep, you know, it not happening. They went for it, and then I popped out. Like, I just scored the World Cup final winner, and then we just kind of travelled around Australia for like 2 years, just in the back of the car. And my first memory of music was being sat outside this cafe as like a nipper, and there was a guy playing like a wine bottle, like a fishing line with wine bottles on it. It was called Catfish the Bottleman. So that was, I thought it'd be an apt thing to call the band after it being my first recollection of music, really. There you go.
Now, don't I feel bad about always slagging off that name? I will say, though, I don't know if the World Cup final analogy fully works, Craig. What do you think?
I did laugh at it, so, I mean, it was entertaining. Also, kind of pinching that guy's name, right? I hope he doesn't come looking for it. Probably won't at this stage. I actually remember interviewing him years back, and he was a very amiable chap and entertaining. And there was definitely at least one song on that album I really liked. Is there one named after a girl? Kind of goes Simpatico.
No, it is not. It is Fallout, I think, is the name of the song you're thinking of.
Possibly. But to me, they were like a less irritating Kooks some good tunes. So.
That's exactly
it. Yes, I stand by this.
Okay, more chat about Catfish and the Bottlemen over on patreon.com/noencore on Sunday. New episodes of Album Club every 2 weeks. patreon.com/noencore. And now, on the usual show...
You're a fucking newsman, John. I ever tell you otherwise, you punch me in the face.
All right, thank you, Will McAvoy. Craig, some serious music news to discuss. Yes. So last weekend, Easter weekend occurred. Everyone had a great time. And I think it was on Friday. I think it was on Good Friday. I found myself sitting in a hipster coffee shop. Where else? And I noticed that a bunch of Eurovision participants this year, including Ireland's representative Bambi Thug, put out a collective statement about their decision to continue and stay in the competition. Of course, there has been months and, you know, lots of growing kind of, you know, disquiet about the event. Entirely, due to the participation of Israel in the competition. Now, of course, many people have been calling for them to be disqualified. The Eurovision organizers said that is not happening. Other people have called for a boycott on the likes of RTE to not broadcast it. One presumes that they certainly still will. And, you know, whether it's Irish Artists for Palestine, whether it's individual people on the ground in music or outside of it, there's massive groundswell of people online basically urging artists to use their platform and by not using their platform to pull out, to not participate, to send a message of support for what is happening to people in Palestine and support of the people over there and the horrors that they are going through and the genocide that is occurring. So last Friday, Ollie Alexander, Britain's representative, like I say, Bambi Thug, others put out this kind of collective statement. And it was a statement that kind of, you know, really like... I thought it was kind of word salad, really.
Yeah.
It just kind of said that we're, you know, we believe in the unifying power of music, enabling people to transcend differences and foster meaningful conversations and connections. And there was talk of, you know, it's better to be there. You know, it's but like it's something similar to that we kind of heard from people when they went to the Qatar World Cup. You know, yeah, like it's Gary better Neville. For me to be there.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, use my voice. But, like, I don't know what that really, really means. You know, like it just felt like a whole lot of kind of $10 words. The reaction was swift and angry. You know, people have kind of said, this is absolutely the wrong move. I put out a tweet just kind of saying that I'm not surprised. This was always going to happen, in my opinion. I think the participating artists involved can dress it up all they want. And they can make kind of overtures to... making some kind of rebellious statement, and maybe they'll do something at the event, and us being there actually is this and is that, whatever. I don't believe any of that. I think it comes down to ego. I think it comes down to these artists wanting the platform, wanting the stage, and that's it. And I'd said before, you know, for example, like Adam and I talked in the show recently about Ireland's representative Bambi Thug, and I like the song. I'm interested by the artist. I'd never heard of them before, so that's a good thing. But I did say, I don't think this is the year to be involved. And however... the acts that kind of banded together, there was about 8 of them, seemed to be unswayed. What do you make of all this, Greg?
I just want to say, I mean, you know, my first time on the show in about 3 months, I'm glad we're getting into Israel-Palestine straight away in the news section. Throwing me in there. I concur with everything you're saying there. I mean, I just think it's such a kind of lily-livered statement. It's just, it is fueled by ego. It's self-serving. It's, we want to go ahead with this. And, you know, to an extent, it's such a kind of once-in-a-lifetime thing. It's a massive platform. You're thinking, you know, in terms of your own career, if I take this stand, it's probably never going to happen for me again. But then you also have to park that and look at the wider context and... first of all, the moral context. I think the statement doesn't hold up whatsoever. This kind of, you know, you accurately described it as word salad. It's just such a meaningless mismatch of like platitudes and the unifying power of music. And what are we uniting by going ahead with this Eurovision, we're uniting people that are acquiescing to the business as usual approach with Israel at a time when, you know, that state is committing horrific acts. So surely the stronger statement is absence, is taking a stand. And yeah, I mean, I agree with you as well. Like, I was delighted to see Bambi Tug picked as Ireland's representative. About time we did something slightly interesting in that realm. And, you know, it could have been a great moment, but I think even for their career, I would be thinking, you know, my move here is to, I'm already kind of representing, you know, the more vulnerable, the people with less kind of voices in the mainstream. If I take this stand, suddenly I become a bit of a cult figure. I will have huge goodwill. I will probably have a ready-made audience for my music and my art going forward in a way that is, you know, Eurovision can be so ephemeral. So I feel like, no, if you actually made a statement withdrew, it could only serve you well. And also, you know, serve the world a bit better. So it's obviously not going to happen at this point, but I'm disappointed.
No, it isn't going to happen. And I will say as well, just real quick, people have said stuff like, oh, contracts have probably been signed. Doesn't matter. Like, you're not going to go to fucking jail. And also, it's the classic case of like, if a contract has been signed, if this makes it harder to do, then that's why you should do it. That's the point. And I just want to quote real quick. Yeah, before I throw it to Adam, I just want to quote real quick because like Irish Artists for Palestine, who obviously have been incredibly vocal and incredibly busy when it comes to everything involving not just the Eurovision boycott, but so much more. They put up a statement a couple of days ago noting that over 2,000 Irish artists have committed to boycotting apartheid Israel. They said that the statement issued by a coalition of 9 participating acts in the Eurovision, including Bambi Thug, rejecting the appeal to boycott the competition in light of Israel's participation is disappointing. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, a leading entity within the global BDS movement, has said, and I quote, engaging in symbolic acts of support while disregarding the plea of the oppressed reflects a patronizing and colonial attitude on the part of the contestants, a sentiment all too familiar to Palestinians and numerous oppressed communities worldwide, end quote. And I guess it's a very long statement from Irish Artists Palestine, but they do once again urge Bambi Thug to boycott it. And like, listen, I mean, like, last thing I'll say on that is, like, I don't think anyone, like, I don't agree necessarily with, like, attacking a Bambi Thug or an Ollie Alexander. I don't think it's going to solve the issue, but I think you can absolutely express your criticism. I can absolutely express your distaste for the actions of continuing to participate.
Yeah, and I also understand also sorry to cut across you, but yeah, it's a huge amount of pressure to be putting on artists that, you know, up to this point haven't done anything wrong. They're now in the spotlight because of forces out of their control. So it's not a great situation for them to be in either. You know,
no, and that, it goes back to, like I said, I mean, like, I just don't think that this is the year for anyone to be involved in. I understand all the reasons why, but when it comes down to the crunch, this was always going to get harder. This was always going to get more spotlight. It will get more spotlight. We're a month out from the event. I wonder if any acts will turn around and say, no, I'm not doing it. Adam.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. I was going to say, do we think that there's going to be a situation where the first domino will fall and a lot of other people will follow? Or, like, this, the hopeful part of me kind of feels like, or wants to believe that someone will do that. But the more kind of cynical, I guess, and realistic part of my brain is telling me that it's just going to be business as usual, which is awful. But I'd love to know what you guys think on that.
I think I'm fascinated to see what becomes of the event itself, what kind of coverage it gets, because like the Eurovision is obviously known for being a very inclusive event and kind of a very much an escapist thing. And it has a huge following. I mean, it's shown in bars. It's The Guardian do a live blog. I mean, like, it's kind of like, will there still be that level of interest? Will journalists who normally do that live blog do the live blog? Will people who, you know, screen it in, you know, in places across Ireland and beyond, will they continue to do so? Does the general public give a fuck? You know, like, I mean, like, it's just that kind of thing. So I think all we can do is kind of sit and watch. But I'm encouraged, obviously, by the actions of Irish Artists for Palestine and many, many others who've made their voices clear on this one. I think it's disappointing to see acts band together and say, no, we can make a difference when they're really just not doing that at all. But like I said before, I'm not surprised in the least. Was I surprised, though, by a story I saw during the week about researchers, or to use tabloidese, you'd call them boffins, at a university in Austria. did this very interesting study. It was kind of like a looking at 40 years of music between 1980 and 2020 and analyzing it from very different kind of forms. But the one that kind of is getting the most headlines is that they've found that song lyrics are becoming simpler and more repetitive, angrier and more self-obsessed over the last 40 years. They assessed 12,000 English language songs across rap, country, pop, R&B and rock, and found that, you know, basically it's reflective of society possibly, but we're in, like, are we in a period where lyrics are being dumbed down? Are they self-centered? Are they this? Are they that? I wasn't surprised by this either, and I don't think it's necessarily a negative. Craig, what do you reckon?
Yeah, like, I wouldn't necessarily look at this through a prism of like, oh, you know, we're getting dumber. I think music trends change. You know, it strikes me as the kind of accusations that were leveraged at like dance music and stuff in the 90s of just like, you know, oh, it's so repetitive. Oh, that's not music. Oh, it's just, you know, a phrase over and over again. Well, I mean, you know, a single mantra, Dave, can be the most profound and enlightening thing in the world. But I'm not surprised because I have seen, I think previously there might have been analyses of just rap lyrics specifically, and that has definitely, like, the vocabulary of rappers has markedly decreased in the last, say, 20 years. Now, a lot of that, I think, has been down to the trend of, you know, mumble rap and SoundCloud rap, and it's not, you know, there's outliers, of course, your Kendricks and stuff, but it isn't that lyrical miracle thing that is in fashion, particularly at the moment. And maybe that has an impact on this wider study because, of course, you know, rap and hip-hop for, you know, I guess this century has been the driving musical force. It is the new pop music. I guess it filters into R&B, of course, pop, rock as well. But yeah, I wouldn't be too worried about this. I mean, like the article does point out, you know, oh, back in the 1960s, you had Bob Dylan topping the charts and he's got a Nobel Prize. But it's like, you know, Kendrick's got a Pulitzer. I don't know. It strikes me as... I'm kind of, first of all, I would love to have this as a job because it sounds really interesting doing that kind of work and number crunching and word crunching. But also, what kind of sample, you know, how accurate can it really be? And just counting words, like, it says nothing of the context and the content. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, 12,000 songs, at least they put the work in. But, you know, there's kind of like, you know, the results confirm previous research, which showed a decrease in positive and joyful lyrics over time and a rise in those that express anger, disgust or sadness. Lyrics have become much more self-obsessed with words such as me and mine becoming much more popular. I mean, like, for starters, like, I don't look to music to be sunshine and rainbows. I often, you know, actually, I say a lot of music I listen to probably has a lot of darkness in it, but I find that kind of cathartic. Sure. I find, like, making music and putting in lyrics to challenge the world around you, is that not what a musician is kind of supposed to do, quote unquote, and also write what you know? It'd be kind of like, sure, listen, you can absolutely, you know, you can make entire concept albums by fictional characters, but, you know, I've got to feel like a lot of, the majority perhaps, that musicians write from is themselves. So it should be about you, and it should be about challenging and asking questions of the world around you, the lived experience. And also, it's 1980 to 2020, fine, they're all different periods of time. However, I think the human brain and the human psyche has been confronted by so much negativity in world events, news coverage, the introduction of social media. Mm. You know, like, I'm not surprised everyone's fucking depressed or pissed off. It's unfortunately a reflection of the way life has gone and how screwed all of us have fucking been over the years. Adam.
Yeah, like, I definitely agree with you in the sense of, you know, I don't necessarily look to find anything like incredibly profound in music, so to speak. And I use it as like an escape, or I use it as a transportative type of thing where it's almost like it's paired with an aesthetic in my head or whatever. But what I would love to know, and maybe I'll actually go and see if this is like published research or if there's like a whole, you know, if there's a, if it's been published anywhere, is what, where the samples came from and what, because like in the grand scheme of things, 12,000 songs isn't a lot of songs, right?
Especially
especially when you consider nowadays when I don't know what the exact figures were, but a couple of like years ago, Spotify came out saying that there was X amount of songs coming out every Friday. I think it was a figure in its thousands. Like, I can imagine a lot of those are in English language. I know a lot of them won't be, but at the same time, I'd love to know if it was like a major label pool or a major label library that they were going to. If that's the case, I think that would be probably more representative of what the study is now showing, you know, and that, because that's what people buy, stuff that's repetitive because it's easily sold. This is stuff that's easily sold, you know. All the profound stuff is stuff that tends to maybe take a little bit longer on the surface before sinking in. So I'd love to know what the pool is.
Yeah, and also, in fairness, as Adam nods to as well, it's worth pointing out, it's important to state that, you know, English language is the English language. There are lots of other languages, the pool is limited by design. It's potentially flawed by design to not go into other languages, other cultures. Automatically, you are, you know, kind of going for a much smaller sample size. And also, like, from my own point of view as well, like, you know, I've nothing against songs with positive lyrics at all, and they can often be helpful, but it's just my natural gravitation is to go the other direction. Like, yours might not be, you know. It's not
unless
like
it's Happy by Pharrell,
which is obviously absolute garbage and should never be listened to by anybody again. I mean, I find myself tiptoeing around the phrase music is subjective, so I'll just move on. But when it comes to repetitive and angry, Adam's beloved Calvin Harris has hit out at people who criticised his Ultra Music set.
He was very upset, wasn't he?
Which was described described as, quote, underwhelming. I mean,
that's a hard one to swallow, though, isn't it? Like, underwhelming, that stings. That's like being kicked in the shin as opposed to, like, you know, getting a punch in the face. It just, like, it feels like it lasts for that little
it's harder
bit
than
it's
hyperbole. Because if someone comes to me and they're like, listen, Dave, you know, that last episode of Encore, I mean, it's pretty underwhelming. I'd be like, fuck.
If they said that was the worst podcast I've ever heard in my life, you'd be like, we're doing something right. But underwhelming is like, oh God, that's a nuanced take.
It's a zero-sum game. So Calvin Harris replied in the comments of a now-deleted post from dance music magazine Dancing Astro, where some users reportedly took issue with Harris's set. He said, quote, you expect me to play none of my songs? How deep is your love? Billion streams. This is what you came for. Billion streams. My way. Billion streams. Streams. He goes on, slide, streams, fields, sure. One kiss. And then he goes, the other five, half a bill, not before 2014, another 20, and not cheesy shit. Proper fucking songs with real artists. I mean, I know
proper
it's an old
proper shoes. Yeah.
Proper shoes. It's an old adage, but if you're explaining you're losing, Craig, what do you reckon of this
100%.
Outburst?
Yeah, I mean, God love him. He's obviously going through it. I wouldn't have thought he was this thin-skinned. Like, it's literally comments under a post that is now deleted. Why is he reading them to begin with? I mean, you know, he's got several billion streams of his songs. Sure, he's got better things to be doing. Also, I don't know a lot of his songs. How Deep Is Your Love? Surely that's the Bee Gees. My Way, surely that's Frank Sinatra. Is he looking at the right numbers?
You ask him, has he got better things to be doing? Well, in other news, he recently revealed his bizarre cure for jet lag. I think this is pretty disgusting, by the way. So strap in, get the seatbelt on. He basically said that it involves eggs, right? He said he was on a British Airways flight a couple weeks ago, and the air hostess... See, he said air hostess. I said stewardess earlier on. Who's the sexist now, you know?
Alvin
Probably
Harris.
Probably still me. He said that she told him she'd never seen anybody crack eggs and pour them into their mouth while sitting in their seat before. And he said, but that was me. That's what I do. This apparently is how he gets rid of jet lag. He said he uses 6 eggs. I like to get rid of the white, so I just do the raw yolk. It gets rid of jet lag. When asked how he manages to get 6 eggs onto a flight without breaking them, he said, you just stick them in your bag. I'm surprised they get through security because for me, that's liquid.
For me.
But it's never, ever been flagged. What's happening?
This is like the weirdest 90 degree turn, isn't it? Like where he's just like, I have all these streams and like people shouldn't think that my performance is underwhelming. Anyway, I love eating raw eggs on planes.
It's, yeah,
disgusting.
I think it's the way that this article is written, though. Adam's right. Like, it's literally one quote into the next. So he goes, I think that's where the majority of my talent lies, making something sound good, so I'd like to make other people's records sound good. I was on British Airways flight only a couple of weeks ago, and the air hostess told me she'd never seen anybody crack eggs and pour them into her mouth.
Loath as I am to defend this man, this could be my formatting, okay? This might be a pre-production error on my behalf, so I can't go there.
My headcanon is that he just, this is stream of consciousness. I think more of him if it's true. I'm going to give this a go. I'm off to Japan soon. I'm going to report back. I'll record it and send it into the show.
Please don't.
First of all, very, very jealous of your Japanese trip. Please go to record stores like seen in the film Perfect Days. I don't know if you've gotten around to that, have you? Gorgeous movie.
Yes, I have. It's fantastic.
Oh, great. Cool. Awesome. Go to the record store in that movie and then send me a photograph or something. But no, please don't eat raw eggs in front of... Like, think of the person sitting next to you, for the love of God. I do love his, you know... For me, that's liquid.
For me,
pretty good.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but for me, that's liquid.
For me,
but it's never
not for
ever
me.
Been flagged. That does surprise me.
You better get flagged now. Some fucking airport security better be reading this and being like, "All right, I'll show him." Another bad review for you. Speaking of bad reviews, also kind of given out this week, Shakira. You know, often in headlines that aren't very good, but she has weighed in on the whole Barbie film debate, you know, from last summer. She's getting around to it now. She did an interview with Allure magazine, and apparently, like, this interview is all about her, quote, she-wolf feminism behind her work. She said that she watched Barbie and said, "My sons absolutely hated it. They felt that it was emasculating, and I agree to a certain extent." She continues, "I like pop culture when it attempts to empower women without robbing men of their possibility to be men."
Get a life, Shakira. Get a life. This is so, this is the fucking most lukewarm take I've ever heard in my life. This is awful. I hate it.
No, listen, guys, I'm fully on board. I mean, I was enjoying Barbie, but like at a certain point I realized like I was really looking forward to the possibility of becoming a man at some point, but I just felt robbed at the end of it. It's all gone.
They took it from you.
Yeah, they took
she
it
says,
from
me. You know, possibility to also protect and provide. I believe in giving women all the tools and the trust that we can do it all without losing our essence, without losing our femininity. I think that men have a purpose in society and women have another purpose as well. We complement each other, and that compliment should not be lost. What's she talking about?
I don't know. I wonder what age her sons are. Imagine they're like 5-year-olds and they're just like, "Why are we watching Barbie?"
There's also, just in case you wonder, is she on the right side of history here? Piers Morgan weighed in to back her up and said, "Hurrah for Shakira. Finally, a high-profile woman prepared to stand up for men being men."
That's when you know your take is the worst take ever, when Piers Morgan's adding you on Twitter being like, "Bravo. Well done. Fuck off. This is terrible."
I mean, it is an unfortunate byproduct that Ryan Gosling is the best thing in the movie, but, you know, he was written and directed by a woman. They can take equal credit.
Ryan Gosling, he's a unicorn. He's an outlier. That's just going to happen.
Did you enjoy his Oscars performance, Craig, of I'm Just Ken?
Yeah, I did, actually. I got kind of swept up in it. I mean, he gave it the full, like, he did it with a lot of gusto and aplomb. I found it funny. Against my better judgment, yes, it was a winning moment for me.
So listen, what hasn't been a winning moment for me is I vowed to go into this year without speaking about Taylor Swift on this podcast anymore, and that's why Craig is going to do the next news story, and I'm just going to sit it out. Go on, Craig.
Thanks, Dave. I thought I was getting away with it this week. Now I'm just a guest and not a co-host. The worst thing of doing this podcast used to be when I would put the running order together and Dave would just be like, "I'm washing my hands of this story. Take it away. Justify its inclusion." But it
you
does
see what
have
happens
someone...
when you leave. I start stitching stories together in bizarre, out of sync fashion that don't make any sense.
Well, I can see why this caught your eye, because it features Laura Dern, who we adore. Friend of the show, possibly. An encore fan.
I sure hope so.
Maybe a patron saint of some kind. But she is backing up Taylor Swift. She's a big fan. She's a Swiftie. She's called her the real deal as a filmmaker after appearing in one of her music videos. This was back in 2022. It was announced pop star had signed a deal with Searchlight Pictures to direct her first movie, with Swift having written the script as well. So she's previously done music videos for The Man, Bejeweled, and All Too Well. Dern was in Bejeweled. She featured alongside the Haim sisters, and she praised Swift's directing skills in a new podcast.
Sorry,
appearance.
Can I Can I do a classic Dave now and just jump in?
Yeah, of course.
Have we ever told the story about the time that you interviewed Haim for Hot Press and what the subsequent headline was, despite your best efforts?
So I had a really good interview with Haim. It was fantastic. Really lovable.
They really
people.
Liked you, if I recall.
Yeah, but they are also, I will say, those kind of people that I think are just kind of charismatic and will make you feel like you're a special person, and then they're probably just on to the next interviewer. Do you know what I mean? But I feel like we had a connection. Anyway, they of course are the Haim sisters, not the Haim sisters, which I pointed out in the article. Didn't write the headline, and the headline was what, Dave?
I believe if memory serves, it was Ready, Haim, Fire.
No!
Which does not work.
Completely undercutting.
No!
The very thing I pointed out in the article.
Yeah, so, this happened a lot back in the Hot Press days, guys, because we wouldn't write it. I mean, like, even you'd submit your own headlines sometimes, but they'd quote-unquote improve it at the subs desk. And, oh man, some of the ones we got over the years were just fucking criminal.
Yeah. That's I think I had something like, you know, the Haim is now or something that actually made sense. It was better than that, but it was something.
They're obsessed with the Ready, Aim, Fire puns. Thing. Anytime they interviewed anybody called Amy, it was always Ready, Aim, Fire. Always. Like, it's happened like 7 times. Nightmare.
I do think that's a good thing to point out, though, for people that aren't in the biz, Hot Press aside, I mean, it is standard practice that, like, oftentimes the actual writer of an article won't put the headline or sub together, and that's usually what gets the journalist who wrote the article in trouble. Like,
can I also just say that, like, I think it's, like, yeah, it is unfortunate because, yeah, people online will go nuts, and, like, you'll sometimes have a journalist come out and say, it wasn't me, publicly, which puts you into a kind of a conflag with your colleagues, which isn't good. I question the system. No, and don't get me wrong, a sub-editor role is a role. It's a great fucking role. I quite like editing myself. You know, it's important and we need more sub-editors in the world. Absolutely. However, I think it's bad practice and ill discipline for journalists to not come up with their own headlines and subs. I just think it's something you should be doing as standard.
Well, you're the person closest to the material. It's, if anything, it's quicker for you to do it when you're in that state of mind. And I think you're the same as me. Just like from my own point of view, I felt like nailing the headline and kind of wrapping it up with a nice bow just kind of made it feel complete to me. Like, you know, I just liked having that sense of like, there's the whole thing laid out and then it would be changed.
Yeah. So I'm calling you out, other journalists who listen to this podcast who don't come up with your own headlines. You should do it as a general courtesy. Sure. But then, of course, the best part about that process is somebody will take that great headline that you've done and run it through a fucking mangler and somehow land you in trouble with the general public. It's great. Anyway, Taylor Swift, Laura Dern says she's going to be a great filmmaker. What do you think?
I mean, there's nothing she can't do, Dave.
She became a billionaire. This week, she did.
I guess are we still praising people that achieve that kind of goal? Good
people
on her.
Hoard immense wealth. You know. Yeah, of course. Like
there should be,
well done,
of course,
girl boss.
No billionaires on the planet at this point. It's getting goddamn ridiculous. She is by no means the worst of them, but Dern was just saying that, like, you know, to quote, on top of everything else amazing that she does and is a real deal filmmaker, which I got to experience firsthand. I'm excited to watch that part of her journey, wherever she continues to take it amongst everything. She said she'd happily take a role in the Swift movie. If ever asked, listen, wherever she wants to go, I'll show up. I love her. Actor in being available for work. Shocker.
Freelancer in give me a call, plea. Come and get me, please, says Laura Dern. Also, I will say, Laura Dern, who is, I mean, like, it's not that she's not a mainstream figure, but she's hardly, you know, out there every day. Smart move. Praise Taylor Swift. Don't give out about her.
Yeah, I think so.
You'll do better.
Canny move.
Lastly, in the news section, just really quick, like super quick to end the news section, Adam found this one and we couldn't resist, Craig. A vault, a treasure trove, if you will, of Marvin Gaye's unreleased music has been discovered and lay hidden in Belgium for over 40 years, apparently. The question is, as a man who once famously said that What's Going On is one of the most overrated albums of all time.
Oh, God damn it. Is that why this was included?
How excited are you about this news story?
I mean, if some of the trash on that supposed classic is what makes the winner.
You might want to clarify just real quick.
Sorry, I'm going to clarify real quick. It's an extremely, very good album. It's just overrated. There are passages where it's more vibes than legit classic songs. It's a, you know, 8.5, but come on, he's got better work. I'm not sure that better work, though, is buried in a vault in Belgium. It's a really weird kind of like arcane way this is described, isn't it? It sounds like the start of some like Da Vinci Code.
It does, you know, like, yeah.
they're going hunting for the secret treasure trove of Marvin Gaye's unreleased music. I don't know. This seems
sorry. I love, by the way, I love that you went full fucking Pitchfork 8.5 decimal. So real quick, while I think of this, Pitchfork this week named Beyonce's new album Cowboy Carter as best new music. They gave it the best new music tag. They gave it 8.4 out of 10, and all the stands were really happy with it. No, they weren't at all, no, were they? They all went crazy, because that's not good enough. And I saw a tweet that said, once again, an overpraised pop star's obsessive fans are complaining that Pitchfork gave the star's new album an extremely positive score and named it Best New Music of the Week, because that's the fucking world we live in. By the way, yeah, everyone's raving about that album. Everyone's raving about that song Bodyguard. I listened to that song Bodyguard, right? Mm. Everyone's saying it's like a song of the summer, man. It's song of the summer. Interesting little demo. I'll be interested to see what she does when she finishes the song, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
The cover of Jolene, my God, like, talk about taking everything that worked about the original and just throwing it away to be like, yeah, I'm the boss. You better, you know, stay away from it. Like, just completely misreading the genius of that song. And, I don't know. I did see someone, quote tweeting Michelle Obama's praise of the album, where it's just like with the cover of like all the, you know, stars and stripes and being like, she's redefining culture, blah, blah, blah. And the person was just like, this is very reminiscent of like Stalinist propaganda around Beyonce at this point. She's just like, you know, the emblem of the United States of America. I don't know. It's all very
Greg, listen,
fawning.
When isn't Beyonce redefining culture? I mean, for the record, yeah, I've no issue with her, apart from I think she's just wildly overrated and her music doesn't really interest me that much. That's all right. I'll get to the album when I get to the album. Renaissance was good. It just wasn't the greatest album of all time.
No, it was bangers,
which tends
on
to kind of, yeah, some really good songs in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, and now to awkwardly pivot to praising a band of men who make music, because unfortunately that's just the way the running order is turned out.
One of whom has collaborated with Beyonce. That could have been
correct.
A segue. Yeah.
Okay.
No, hold still, up. Wrote the hook to hold up.
Okay, fine. You've saved this podcast once again.
Yeah.
And I haven't. So it's time for our top five. So there is a new Vampire Weekend album out. I haven't heard a single note of music off this new album. I haven't heard a single single. I'm waiting until I hear the album in full. I don't like their last album. We've talked about it on the podcast before. We'll get to it all. I haven't. So top five time. It's top five Vampire Weekend songs. But obviously, I think we're going to get a bit of a career overview here, and you know, a lot of Craig. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of personal reflection here. But I haven't had a chance to do this for such a long time. So Craig Fitzpatrick, can you please give us a primer?
Oh no,
on Vampire Weekend.
Sure, Dave. Yeah. Vampire Weekend, New York's finest.
He's really back.
Columbia University's finest. That might be a smaller little demographic. I would say an act with like at least a couple of era-defining albums, but to my mind, they're more of a like a bit of a bridge band. Like they're a bit of an outlier. They arrived at, you know, the tail end of that post-millennial New York indie explosion, and like they immediately felt like a more refined kind of worldly, canny kind of proposition than, you know, the early kind of standard bearers like your Strokes, your yes,
your Interpols,
your Interpols.
Your
they were less narrow and focused. They were kind of looking out at the world a bit more. They were probably got up people's noses, but I thought at the time a real breath of fresh air. So it was really around the time of, you know, the blog era breaking bands. They were a blog era Tumblr buzz band that arrived with a bunch of songs that had like, you know, Afrobeat, but they were wearing Argyle sweaters and talking about Cape Cod, you know, Cape Cod, Kwasa Kwasa. And I guess doing things very differently in a way that had real quirky appeal. There's like a really interesting section in that Meet Me in the Bathroom book about that whole kind of scene. And it basically concludes with Vampire Weekend being kind of the band that maybe had the most commercial success and, you know, drew the curtain on that era.
They feel almost like the really preppy, clean cut death knell that comes along.
I think by their own admission,
they're kind of like, we don't fit in with these guys, and we're kind of intimidated by them, but also we're the future by.
Yeah, yeah, and it is funny reading that book. Like, I might grab a passage out of it here. It's as per usual, I have it on my desk, but
open to the exact page.
It's funny though, because like after hundreds and hundreds of pages of bands infighting and like, you know, squandering their career prospects and drug taking and nocturnal activities and kind of sleaziness, they're like instantly talking about like, my favorite drug is like freshly brewed coffee in the morning. You get it up there and go on. It's like, wow, times are changing. But yeah, like the chapter on them opens, it's like that, it's headlined breezier and lighter and quicker. So basically, yeah, they're talking about Vampire Weekend, the different mishmash of influences. But basically, this guy, Steve Ralbowski, has a really good quote here. So he says, sorry, I'll just get on mic. There was a uniformity of musical inspiration that characterized a lot of the downtown New York bands at the time, as well as the White Stripes and Kings of Leon. It was more of a rock and roll thing. Vampire Weekend was quirky and folky and had these African rhythms, lyrics that were kind of dreamy, whimsical, kooky, and non-narrative. Ezra had a voice that didn't suffer from irony, angst, and heaviness, that minor chord rock and roll stuff. It was a breath of fresh air. So yeah, I think that's... it was just a complete sea change, really. And from there, they just capitalized on their kind of early success. I mean, I think they were probably careerist in the right sense, just in terms of being creatively ambitious. So the debut album, self-titled one, was all... well, like there are bands that talk in definite nouns a lot. So to go through the albums like that, I do have a few notes. So self-titled debut, right, was Oxford Commas, Lil Jon, Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, and Peter Gabriel. Then Contra was Billboard number one.
Craig hasn't picked a single song yet, so strap in, get ready. Get yourself a nice, freshly brewed cup of coffee. Keep going.
Ska-based radio hits, RZA and Jake Gyllenhaal tennis matches and music videos. Modern Vampires of the City was Sky Ferreira, New York and the Smog, Saab's on Fire, pitch-shifted songs about God, and Pitchfork Acclaim. Did you like that one? Yeah, that was good. And just to wrap up, here we go.
And you say you're not a music journalist anymore. My God, I'm so proud of my boy.
And Father of the Bride was California Contentment, flipping pancakes in luxurious dressing gowns, country duets with Haim, not Haim, the White Album and the Grateful Dead, and crunchy sounds and light sounds that didn't jive well with Dave at the time. And probably the last time we properly talked Vampire Weekend was when that album came out, and we both gave it 6 out of 10. You gave it 5 out of 10. I can't quite remember.
Feels like a 5 or a 4. I've never gone back to it. You of course had your, you had yet another of your Craig mad scientist reactions to it, where you were like, there's a great album in here, I will find it and I will construct it.
You just don't know this album like I do.
It's not like, well, other it was their, albums.
It was their shaggy kind of double, you know, sprawling.
Craig, it was fucking terrible. It was awful. It was absolute garbage. It was formless. It was smug. It was horribly self-indulgent. It caused Rostam to be like, I'm gone. Goodbye.
No, hold on, hold on. Rostam had left the band. And what happened was... we should
point out,
yeah,
better. Rostam, my narrative is better. That's
Bob Mangley,
saying,
who was probably the twin creative kind of force with Ezra Koenig, the band being completed with the two Chrises, Chris Thompson and Chris Baio, he decided that he would step away after Modern Vampires because... it's still a bit like unclear what happened there, but by all accounts, like I think Ezra said, Rostam never really felt like he was a proper member of the band. He saw himself as like a producer, someone who worked on sounds, and that's what he was contributing to Vampire Weekend, and he eventually just wanted to be seen as under his own name and do his own thing. So I think what Father of the Bride turned out to be was almost an Ezra solo project, where he moved to California, spent like 6 years working on material with a kind of revolving cast of people, got into the Grateful Dead and, you know, jam band stuff, and decided to make his own White Album. And I think it's a totally, it's a total sea change from Modern Vampires of the City, but I think it was necessary. I think there's a really good record in there. Like, he's pointed out that, like, what could he do after Modern Vampires? Like, you look at the cover of that where it's, you know, New York in the smog, it's really dark. He's like, where'd you go from there? Like, is the next album cover going to be, like, war photography? Like, I needed to just have, you know, a bright planet, a bit of sunshine, just a clean slate. And that's what it was. And I stand by it. But anyway, there's a new album.
I will say, just before we move on, going back to Rostam just there, it jogged my memory that we got a comment from patron David Kelly this week, who said, I'm as excited for Craig's return as I would be for Rostam coming back to put some manners on Ezra. Man. So there you go.
The second part of that sentence hurt, but
no pressure then, Craig. Okay.
Listen, you're Ezra in this situation, Dave.
No. That is not conflated within the comments.
Yeah, I will say, before we get into this top five, Dave, you haven't been listening to any of the new tracks.
No, because it's a curiosity thing. It's not even like, I genuinely want to hear the album blind. I want to just go
can
in
we can we
like,
have a I ha, do have a snippet of it just
I
for
thought
the
you I thought you might do this, so it's yes. The only time I'll allow it until
okay,
of course
okay.
This Friday when I will have heard the album.
Okay,
so go
right,
on, you might you might as well.
Thanks for indulging
this long.
Me I appreciate
I've waited
it.
This long. I'll indulge okay. You all day, buddy.
This is Mary Boone. Here we go.
Mary Boone, I'm on the dark side of the room. Mary Boone, Mary Boone. Well, I hope you feel like loving someone soon.
Coming up fair with a big smile on my face, because I think they might have me again.
From Only God Was Above Us. It's,
that was
yeah,
good.
Yeah,
that was good. No, I sound like I don't want it to be good. Of course I do. But I fell hard in love with this band on the third album, and I fell
yeah.
just as hard out of it on that horrible fourth record. I hope it's good. I really hope it's good. I'd heard nothing up until that snippet. I'm excited. I will listen to it first thing Friday morning. But what I want to listen to right now, what we've all come for, Craig, is
yeah,
your top
it's
five.
It's my top five. Okay, so let's start at number five. And this is probably something that you don't want to listen to, because I had to get a mention in of Father of the Bride. So we'll get it out of the way, good and sharpish. But just for, you know, telling the whole story, here is a terrific track from that record.
City was freezing, an elegant flow. Wind at the door, where it wasn't badly cold. You walked to the bedroom, sat down to write. The page of your notebook was unbearably wide. There's an avalanche coming. Don't cover your...
Yeah, so that was Unbearably White. And I think it probably ticks a lot of the Vampire Weekend boxes from previous albums, just in terms of it being quite self-referential, layered in terms of lyrical meaning. Like, it's that kind of typical writerly thing that Ezra Koenig will do, where he takes a phrase that intrigues him and applies new meanings to it. So obviously, like, there was an article written, I'm not sure it was specific to Vampire Weekend, but it was certainly about that grouping of indie artists at the time, with them kind of as spearheads, called the Unbearable Whiteness of Indie. And obviously, like, when they came out, they were from, you know, an Ivy League college, and they were talking about summering on the Cape and all that kind of stuff, and they were seen as quite, you know, waspish. They were at pains to point out that no one in the band was from a WASP kind of background. So, you know, Persian guy, Jewish guy, people that were on scholarships to go to college. Like, I think it was more just them being intrigued by that boozier style of life than actually being it. But for sure, there was definitely criticisms you could level at them. So it's him playing around with that, but also using the unbearable whiteness as a jumping off point of, like, I guess removing himself from that scene as a whole, leaving behind indie rock. What do I do now? Is the band even still a thing? The pressure of, you know, the unbearably white notebook, when you're like, okay, is this writer's block? Am I going to take 6 years to come up with the next song? I love the kind of guitar lick here. I love the strings, little kind of playful sound effects. I don't know, is that like a Microsoft sound or something, that jolty thing? It's just cool to me. Like there's playful stuff throughout that record, which I think works really well. But this is just, I think, in the canon, it's right up there. And I think it's a good explainer for why he felt the need to move on. And we can move on unless you have comments on that one.
Yeah, no, yeah. I wanted to ask at some point, and I guess you've kind of, you know, introduced it now. So were any of the cultural appropriation criticisms fair? Or for the reasons that you've outlined, that maybe this band is actually a lot more diverse than people initially thought they were, not fair? I mean, because I feel like they definitely were at a certain point, and people were kind of like, all right, lads, joke's over. You're just fucking ripping off African music, and this is ridiculous. And you're all pristine white lads, even though they're not. But like, yeah, that was definitely a narrative, right, that did form.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there is definitely a discussion to be had around that. Now, like we've talked about, you know, being a culture vulture and the pros and cons of that in the past. And my stance has always been that as long as you're not like directly ripping off from, you know, people at the expense of them getting their payday or anything like that. I mean, surely the creative arts are all about like a mix of influences and not getting into Eurovision statements, but the unifying power of music. But I actually think they were more cosplaying the preppy thing more so than cosplaying as like, you know, some kind of
Ezra Koenig's world music experience.
Yeah, for sure. I think it was all quite mannered and knowing, and they were like, it's slightly meta. And I don't think, I think even by the second record, they'd moved on to that, and their influences were more into kind of dance and hip hop and synths and things like that. I think they were a good example of probably just voracious music lovers that were having fun creating. I mean, maybe that's just giving the benefit of the doubt, but I do agree that.
Yeah, and we're not the authority now, on this, by the way.
Yeah, it would be. Of course.
Unbearably white men ourselves. Like, I mean, I'm not going to be like, well, and that's the end of that chapter. I'm just curious as to what the kind of consensus is here. And like, or rather, you know, I think there's definitely valid, you know, criticisms to be made.
Well, there's precedent of, you know, it's, you know, you're talking heads, you're Paul Simons and Gracelands, and I mean, where do you stand on those? I mean, I would see them as positive things, but you could also say, well, it's privileged people just playing around with other art forms. I don't know, but I like the music. Okay, so let's move on and move backwards to the second record, which I think is a bit slept on, actually. I'm not going to say it's their masterpiece. I think it might be another masterpiece. I go back to it quite a bit, and this is maybe the second best song on it. Spoilers for future songs, but here we go.
Chances now then, but I never had the feeling I could offer that to you. To offer it to you would be cruel, when all I want to do is use you. It was a diplomat's son.
With head bobbing there, I was diplomat's son.
I can't not bob my head to Vampire Weekend, like when they're in that groove. I find myself just unable to just
buoyant,
sit still.
Yeah. I really wanted to include something a bit peppier as well, like a White Sky or a, like Fingerback, which is just so infectious. But because they do that really like just having a good summer's day, life is good thing really well. But this is a bit more layered,
a bit more
of a groove. Yeah. It's and the sample in the background is MIA. Which is really nicely done. It's a wonderful production. And this is where his last track was obviously more Ezra. And we should say Ariel Rekshad, who has kind of almost replaced Rostam in the band in terms of being, you know, the producer, who in terms of being another key creative force with them. But this is really Rostam's influence, I think, musically here. It's kind of his production, his really Midas touch, I guess, at the time, just kind of bringing again those different influences together that shouldn't quite work. You know, Jamaican kind of bouncy piano, but also like that violin on top, the glitchy electronic synths that they kind of abandoned after this record, but was definitely an interesting direction they could have gone. They just kind of went darker. And lyrically, again, it was another great collaboration between the two of them, because it was based, I believe, initially on a short story that Ezra wrote in college about, I think, like a homosexual tryst or something imagined like that. And Rostam took great inspiration from it because he felt it related a lot to his life and his experiences with his kind of sexuality. So he kind of took that as inspiration and then developed the lyrical themes from that. And then they combined on the lyrics. So it's getting very convoluted here. But it basically is telling Rostam's story through this interesting Salinger-esque preppy diplomatic kind of throwback lyric, and that's a word salad, but it's a great song.
I mean, actually, like hearing you talk about it and kind of unpack it in that way makes me think about our earlier news story, and I'm like, could Vampire Weekend be accused of being angry and repetitive and simple and dumbed down and self-obsessed?
I know, I mean, right? Yeah,
I don't think so, right? They're definitely one of the more, you know, for better and for worse, I think, yeah, you know, lyrical and kind of, again, not so much $10 world, but like $10 words, but like the narratives can be complex. And the music, of course, there's a lot going on. But like, I'm curious as to how you think of them lyrically.
Well, I'm a sucker for a nice turn of phrase. I do think there's great narratives that are stuff. It's often like his songs, again, you know, it's a full band effort, but a lot of the time you don't feel like, you know, with a lot of indie band, it's heart in the sleeve stuff. It's direct personal experience. With Ezra's work, I feel like he's coming almost from a more literary point of view, where he's often like the unnamed narrator of a story, which works really well. Like just doing a kind of, you know, almost like a Great Gatsby thing. Well, obviously, you know, there is a named narrator in that. It's Nick Carraway. But, you know, that thing of like he is kind of surveying the scene, setting the scene and musing over it in quite a kind of philosophical way. But you can kind of apply your own stuff to these very deliberate, dense passages. So there's a lot to unpack. Like I think they are an act that are, if they had probably released more material over the years, that are primed for a, like, you know, there's a great blog on like, say, Bowie or REM, where they will literally go methodically, or even Dylan, through every song and go, here's the five different references in this one line. Like actually my interview with Ezra back when Modern Vampires came out, there's a kind of very quaint now passage where we talk about the website rapgenius.com. And he's like, yes, I know of it. And I'm like, bizarrely for like an indie band, there's actually Vampire Weekend lyrics on this website, because it was still very much hip hop back then. And there was all the kind of references. I think they were one of the first acts of that ilk where people were annotating stuff. And I love a good annotation.
Yeah, you do. You're famous for it. Okay, so we've had Unbearably White. We've had Diplomat's Son. What's next?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with probably your fave. Maybe a shock number three.
In Santa Barbara, Hannah cried and missed those freezing beaches. Some kindling for the fire, and I told the New York Times I've been to pieces.
What are you doing? What are you doing to me? Not only do you pick this, you don't pick the kick in. Are you out of your fucking mind?
That kick in is like, yeah, one of the most famous kick ins in like recent
indie boy times. Indie boy history. Dave and Craig, like, Moore.
We've played it, I think, many times on the show before, and I just assume everyone listens to every episode, so I didn't want to repeat
Hannah
myself.
The song is Hannah Hunt, by the
way,
everybody.
The song is Hannah Hunt. Everyone knows
as
Hannah
as
Hunt.
As Craig and I go as inside baseball as we can and just have a moment with each other, I leaned back in my chair and nearly, like, passed out when it came on.
Well, it's like, yeah, You can almost talk about this as, you know, more, as much, if not more, than I can, but yeah.
Well, I mean, yes, I will, I do want the reasons why you chose it, of course. Selfishly, yeah. Craig, I want you to curate your own top five, but Hannah Hunt by Vampire Weekend, which of course, this is one of the reasons why, you know, you were like, are you also going to do five? And I said, no, I want to kind of chime in from the sidelines and yeah. be a bit more of that lately, but also, you know, come on, like... This is a given. I'm going to pick this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's one of the best songs I've ever heard in my entire life. I think it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It always kind of stops me in my tracks. I think it's quite magical. I think it's indicative of the album as a whole. It's my favorite Vampire Weekend album. I think it's a masterpiece. I also have very fond memories because, like, when you were talking about the thing of them conjuring up this kind of carefree summer day, you know, me being me, sometimes that can make me feel quite melancholic, and it can feel like you're reading Calvin and Hobbes and you're trying to have these idyllic summers that you never really had. You know, it's that kind of yeah. weird, you know, bought in nostalgia from culture, which can play with your fucking brain and it can trick your mind. And, you know, like, it's a summer isn't always a great time, especially if you're someone who struggles with mental health issues. However, there are forms of escape, and sometimes they come in the form of a song. And sometimes you're listening to that song with one of your best friends, as I was with my often mentioned friend Adam. Back in Drogheda, when this album came out, I was due to review it. I reviewed it for State Magazine, which, of course, was... you know, a kind of a legendary underground hot press rival that unfortunately didn't last the run. And I guess I still was working with Hot Press at the time, but not really. I was kind of in that, you know, I'm on freelance, aka I'm doing nothing, I'm not getting called up. And even if I was, it wasn't the greatest experience anyway. So I was trying to branch out and become a writer and, you know, do a bit more and find my independence and find my voice and use it. And so, like, something that Hot Press would never have let me do, which would be review the third Vampire Weekend album. Or maybe they fucking would have. I mean, they probably didn't care that much. But, like, long story short, I got the album early. I got the advance stream of it a few weeks out, and I loved it. I think I loved it from the first listen. I think as soon as Obvious Bicycle came on, I was like, okay, there's something happening here. And I just remember vividly playing it for my buddy, who was home from whatever travel he was on at the time. And I remember very vividly being in my bedroom. We were playing FIFA. We were sinking a beer. I put this on. Hannah Hunt came on. We just sat there listening to it. The kick in happened. I feel like we clinked glasses and, like, had a smile, and fucking sun just burst through the window. And maybe I'm misremembering it. Maybe it is that borrowed nostalgia. But
there is no Adam.
Imagine this person I've mentioned it's so
your Tyler
many times.
Durden. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, we blew up lots of buildings together.
Yeah. We destroyed
and,
capitalism.
Know, like,
yeah.
And the Pixie song came on, and it was great. But no, I mean, there you go. You got me going all romantic. And that's what this song kind of does. And I think it's a classic. Anyway, it's Craig's number three, not mine. So why don't you talk about it? And while you're talking about it, actually, because you teased it there, you did interview Ezra Koenig on this album. And I want you to talk about that interview, if you don't mind.
Yeah, he was very charming. I think I was even more charming, to be quite honest. I gave a really good account of myself, if I recall correctly. But
you often did.
He's a very considered guy. Like, obviously, he's got a deep love for music in all its forms, and that lyrical thing where you can actually ask him pressing, probing questions about the content of the album, and he won't just be like, yeah, whatever you want yourself. He'll, like, get into the specific reference points and all that kind of stuff. And I think this was a big moment. You know, Modern Vampires, I think, captured quarter life crisis for a lot of people that were into this kind of indie, you know what I mean? It was just like people on the cusp of their 30s as he was, or mid 20s, and just going, where do we go from here, and reckoning with aging. And that's certainly stuff he said he was doing at the time. So yeah, there was a lot of heavy chat around that.
If I recall as well, I think it was slated to be a 2-page interview, but you fought to get it as a cover.
Yeah, it was a full cover. Yeah, it was the full
as it
cover
should have been
story.
Because I remember reading it. You had the transcript, and I read the transcript, and I was like, this is fucking great. This is really, really good.
Oh, thanks, yeah.
Don't let them just be a 2-pager. And, you know, that was an argument that we often did not win, but you won that one.
Yeah. I was very pleased with the piece. I thought it came together really well. I will say your one criticism of it, after you read it, was you had to have, like, a little mention of Ireland at the end, didn't you? And I still push back on that.
Hey, listen, I'm the one who ended up working for fucking joe.ie here, so...
Hold on a sec. I have my piece here. Can
tremendous.
Can I set the record straight? Okay, because
if memory serves, it ends with some kind of, you know, like next pints on me when you come. No, I'm joking, but it's very. There is definitely like a crowbarred in Irish thing, isn't there? There definitely is.
But hold on, in my defense, right? This was for them headlining Longitude, so there had to be at least some reference to the fact that they were going to be coming to Ireland, right? But I will say,
yeah, that's called the stamp at the very end, where literally you end with Vampire Weekend play Longitude on July 5th. That's it.
Also, back in the day, this is how far back we're going. This is before Longitude became like the rap festival. This was Longitude had like
the first one.
Yeah, it had like a nice purple patch of like 4 years where it was like the indie festival. It was like the thing where bands like Vampire Weekend came to play in Ireland, and
it was the start. But anyway, I will say, right, he, unprompted by me, while we were talking about like his approach to lyrics almost being like this album's like a collection of short stories, which you obviously hear a lot, but he said unprompted, like, that's how I feel. Oh, here's the quote. That's how I feel about something like Dubliners. He brought up Dubliners. I didn't mention Ireland, right? And I know for a fact he does like Dubliners. He says it's one of my favourite books, and it's a collection of stories which is more or less about one place, one time period, yet the tone of every story is so different. They all come together to give this bigger vibe, and for me that really feels like an album. And then I closed with Ezra Koenig and his fellow Weekenders will occupy a space, if not time, that's close to the heart of James Joyce when they bring their modern vampires to Dublin. It's not New York, but it's a chance to be part of their unfolding story. That's it.
Adam has his hand up. I'm sorry, I'm doing it. I can read your mind. I'm not letting you out with his fellow Weekenders. Not happening. That's ridiculous. That was,
I didn't refer to them as Vampy Weeks once, though, which is a win.
Do people do that?
I wasn't gonna go yeah. there. I was gonna say, did you tell him that I'm not from fucking Dublin? I'm from Kildare, mate. did you give him a bit of that?
Craig cosplayed as a Dubliner himself in many ways. Still does.
So, Ezra, do you know much about the history of Leixlip? Home of Guinness. The Rolling Stones played there in the 80s. Yeah,
just the sound of a landline phone in New York just buzzing out. Anyway, Hannah Hunt, yeah, good song.
Really great. And I had the same reaction as you, but I was alone. No, I was also reviewing the album for Hot Press, and my first listen through, I was like, yeah, this is sounding good. But you know, you'll often have that moment of like, okay, they've knocked it out of the park. The remainder of this album I know is going to be great, because it's like that break, that drum break, I was like, oh, this is a fucking important record that people are going to remember. This is happening. And it got me very excited as well. And that's Hannah Hunt. It's a masterpiece.
This is happening by LCD Sound System, your favorite.
This is happening.
Please, everyone, right. If you've not heard the No Encore top 5 most overrated albums, go back to that one from 2020 and enjoy Craig's rant about LCD Sound System, which I still love to this day. Anyway, let's have your silver medal in Vampire Weekend category, please.
Cool. My silver medal is for a real, well, they're all personal favourites, but a real deep cut personal favourite, which I think is maybe kind of similar to a Hannah Hunt in terms of approach, but it's from the previous album. We're back to Contra, which is interesting in terms of representation, and it is this.
Driving around, sure of myself, sure of it now. You stand so close to me, like the future was supposed to be. In the aisles of the grocery, in the blocks uptown. I remember, remember well. But if I'd forgotten, could you tell? In the shadow of your first attack, I was questioning and looking back. You said, baby, we don't speak of that. Like a real.
Yeah, it's Taxi Cab. It's, I think, you know, the first album was very clever, and you had stuff like Oxford Comma that was wry, and there was some nice, you know, college campus storytelling. But I think Contra really introduced something a bit more personal and a bit deeper. And this is just a very meditative kind of reflection on a relationship that didn't quite pan out. But once again, it being Vampire Weekend, there's layers, and it's interesting to look at comments under Yeah, you know, these days, Dave, I'm a big fan of like YouTube comments. I think there's some gold in there.
Listen, but, you know who you're talking to. You know?
Yeah.
You got the right. But, like, you got the right. You know, people, here, Greg, big time.
There's so many theories about like this song. Even it's just, you know, it's dealing with class privilege. It's just purely about the breakup of a relationship. Then there is a very long comment about someone's theory that it's about 9/11. And
I mean, isn't like
culture wars post 9/11? Yeah. But I just think there's some of his best writing in this. I want to include it just in case people kind of been sleeping on it, maybe. I love the production on it. It's again that kind of just ornate thing they do so well, but it's a slow build. It reminds me quite a lot of Lou Reed's Street Hustle, which is just almost a kind of near spoken word thing. This is a bit more melodic, but just over these repetitive kind of hypnotic strings. And yeah, this is one I return to quite a bit. And I think it just kind of, it paved the way for everything that was going to come, and you know, the fruition of the greatness of the band. And with that in mind, we can get to the number one.
Well, the question becomes, with just one song remaining,
mm-hmm.
is anything from the debut album going to feature?
Let's find out.
Every time I see you in the world, you always step to my girl. Ancestors told me the Dagger was better. She's richer than Croesus, she's tougher than leather. I just ignored all the tales of a past life. Say a conversation deserves but a bread knife. And punks who would laugh when they saw us together, well, they didn't know how to dress for the weather. I could still see them there huddled on Aster. Snow falling slow to the sound of the master.
Take that, self-titled album yeeted out of existence as far as Great Stuff 5 is concerned.
And I love that album. It's great. It fills me with joy. It should be a compliment to any act, right? That you don't, you know, the first album was big and yet you don't pick any of the songs from the first album when it comes to their career retrospective. This was Step, of course, which is my favorite Vampire Weekend song. It's from Modern Vampires. It was always going to be number one. I know a lot of people would probably go Hannah Hunt is like the, you know, the most accomplished, you know, in the Great American Songbook thing that they have. But Step to me is just like,
I think people go with Yeah Hey a lot, actually.
Really?
That kind of
that's also great. Yeah, I mean, that's also amazing. I couldn't just do a full list of Modern Vampires. If I had a gone debut album, I mean, Mansard Roof was the first thing I ever heard of them, and it's just kind of sets their stall out so brilliantly. It's, yeah, it's insane. There's loads from the, go listen to the debut. It's, everyone has
I've
the
got,
debut. It's
great. I've got a couple of big soft spots for I Stand Corrected and Walcott.
Oh. Yeah, I Stand Corrected. Walcott's brilliant, yeah, and it's a really good, like, kind of closing, just rousing thing. I Stand Corrected was in consideration for me because I think it's
great song.
Yeah. It's very funny. Like, it's very dry, the lyric of just being like someone picking you up on a mistake you've made. I don't know if you've experienced that at all, Dave, in recent times.
No, absolutely not. No. Infallible over here. And no one ever pulls me up on anything, so that's good.
Yeah. But yeah, I just love that deadpan chorus of I Stand Corrected.
Corrected.
So good. Yeah.
Great song.
And also maybe the most like the Walkmen that they ever sounded. There's a touch of that in that song.
Yeah, I mean, you could make an argument for Cousins to a degree, and just in some of the kind of breakneck drums. I will agree with you as well that the second album is underrated. The first one means a lot to me. You know, it's The Way In. I also saw them at Oxygen 2008. I remember dancing terribly to stuff like Walcott. But anyway, you're back to the third album. You're back to the masterpiece? Question mark.
I think for me, like, you know me, I'm a sucker for songs about songs and songs about like people's relationship with music and what it kind of means to them. And yeah, like Step is all about that. It is, you know, Step to My Girl is, well, the girl is music and the culture I've kind of grown up with and the tribes I've been part of, you know, getting obsessed with this art form and how it's made me feel like an insider and an outsider and how things have changed. You've got that brilliant sample of the Souls of Mischief song, Step to My Girl, which in turn samples Grover Washington, I think. Then you've got, you know, the classical mixed really well with that. So something old, something new, just working really well together. And just dense lyrics, which I adore. You know, your references to Anger Wash, your references to Champagne and Disco and Boombox and Walkman. It's also a song about getting older and how I think creativity and art can help you make those adjustments and, you know, is always there as a companion on your journey. And it has, I think, his best moment in terms of lyricism, which is that middle eight, which again, I didn't pick that specific clip because I think we've used it previously, but it's, you know, that thing of like, you know, wisdom's a gift, but you trade it for youth. Age is an honor. It's still not the truth. And blah, blah, blah. Gets me every time. So yes, this is the one that is probably on my all time list of songs. I would take to my, you know, Desert Island Disc. Whenever I get the shout out for the Desert Island Discs program, this might be included. And that's my number one.
I feel like that shout is definitely coming from Lauren Laverne after she hears this episode.
So.
Although she might be like, well, he's just done it. You know, he's done it on
he's
a superior
done it, yeah.
podcast.
He said it all.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, something I forgot to mention, which I heard recently, which I think is funny, just about Hannah Hunt, because I obviously we were repeating ourselves about, you know, just praising Hannah Hunt. But the band didn't really think people liked it initially. And they're like, oh, it's a real deep cut. Like it's one, you know, that the hardcore fans like. I'm like, well, I think it was pretty popular immediately, but it's based on the fact that they played like a huge show in Korea around the time of that record. And, it was towards the end of the set and they like started up Hannah Hunt and they call it, I think their Burt Wonderstone song now. Because what happened was Chris Thompson, the drummer, was playing drums as you do. And for Hannah Hunt, he would always close his eyes and just like, you know, get into the moment. And they're playing in front of a sea, just thousands and thousands of people, this Korean kind of festival show. He closes his eyes, they play Hannah Hunt. And when he opens his eyes, more than half the audience has vanished. They'd all left. Because it was just, I guess, like not high octane enough. It wasn't Walcott. And he was just like, what the hell? So they call it the Burt Wonderstone of their catalogue because if you've seen that film, it's like the parody of like The Prestige, which is like, you know, it's easy to make yourself disappear. The greatest trick you can manage is to make the audience disappear. So yeah, that was my Hannah Hunt anecdote, which I found quite funny. And that's me. That's my top five.
So in reverse order, Craig, give us your top five.
So we had Unbearably White. We had Diplomat's Son. We had Hannah Hunt at number three. Taxi Cab. Deep cut, and then had to be Step, number one.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily have predicted all of those. You took us on a journey. I guess in closing, one must ask, because you have been paying attention to the singles. I believe there have been a few of them released so far for the new record. What are your expectations for this new album?
I don't want to get too overzealous, but I think they're back. No, it seems like it's, I think I've been avoiding, there is leaks, but I've been avoiding the leaks because I want to sit down with the full record. I have been listening to the single so, and they're all very strong. I think the sound is like touches on a lot of the old stuff, but it's noisier, it's interesting, it's eclectic. The two Chrises are properly back. Like it's a full band reunified. There's some great rhythm section stuff going on. It feels like they're picking up where Modern Vampires left off. So yeah. And yeah, 10 tracks. Apparently it's all killer.
Rostam's not there, is he?
He's not, but he's also credited on a couple
of the songs.
That's not
a full band, is it? Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah, that's fair. But he does have some co-writes, I think, and so some co-productions, so, but he's not back in the band.
There's a flavor there.
Still friends then, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, okay. I'm spent, Craig. That was emotional. That was beautiful. Yeah. That was wonderful. That was Craig's top five Vampire Weekend.
Woo.
Thank you very much, my brother.
Thank you.
All right. So, yes, as we said earlier in the show, it is patreon.com/noencore if you want to hear some curation from Adam this Sunday, the debut episode of the No Encore Album Club, Adam taking you through The Balcony by Catfish and the Bottlemen, what it means to him, what the band mean to him, and what it might mean to you. So patreon.com/newencore. €5 gets you in, gets you this episode 24 hours early, gets you weekly previews, and we always like to hear from you as well. So, you know, get in touch, please do. And if I've, you know, I'm sure I've done lots of double negatives on this episode, by all means, let me know. I love criticism. It's my favorite thing in the world, guys. And as for, you know, as for next week's show, all I'll say is I hope you like wrestling. Goodbye, everybody. My name is, it's WrestleMania weekend, Craig. You sign up for it? Yeah. I assume you've booked work off Monday morning, have you?
Of course, yeah. It's that I'm flying to Japan specifically to see the wrestling which is happening in Japan, right?
You know as well that, you know, you can watch more wrestling matches because of the time difference flying back and to and from Japan.
Yeah,
you
can do a whole maybe I'll manage to get on the plane somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, there might be someone very there, exciting. Who knows? But yeah, who's gonna win the main event, do you think, Craig?
I'm feeling really good about Macho Man Randy Savage.
Really? Macho Man Randy Savage has been dead deceased for about 21 years at this stage, whatever it is.
What?
Sorry. All right, my name is Dave Hanratty. This has been No Encore. There will be No Encore, and we're back next week. Patreon.com/No Encore. Check out the album club. Goodbye. Much love.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.